Hi, my name is Amanda Groves, and I live in Benton, Kentucky. I depend upon the ACA because right now I'm not a full-time employee. I work part-time. I'm a substitute in the schools, and I'm also a student in seminary pursuing a second career, which I am very excited about. So it is because of ACA that I have the freedom to pursue my dream, do something different, and look out for my family. My husband has health issues. He can't drive, and he has several medical appointments. So it would be very hard for me to work a full-time job. So it has been very beneficial to me. I get supplements from the government. I'm not on Medicaid, but I do get some help from the government. But I still have a pretty high premium, pretty high deductibles. And so I still have medical bills, so that it is not a free ride. And so single payer would be the best answer for everyone involved. Even though I have insurance, I have really bad knee issues. They need to be replaced, but I can't do it because I do not have the funds saved up to do something like that, to commit myself to something like that. So single payer would allow me to live my life to the fullest.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Mike O'Connell. Feel very passionate about the concept of a single payer health system. I think it's the only way that we in every state and in this country can find a way to ensure that every citizen of the United States of America has adequate and competent health coverage at a reasonable rate, fashioned around a formula that everyone can afford and everyone will be covered. And it won't be just for those who have the money to be able to buy the best health care they can. And I think that a health care system run on profit per se and with an idea of dividends to pay to shareholders is no longer workable in this society as it's, and I think worldwide. It's just not an answer, and I hope that eventually we'll see this happen in Kentucky and all over the country.
Good deal. Thanks, Mike.
The searing memories in my life is being in a children's hospital in Boston when my son, who had lost his leg to cancer, and he was under a regime that was going to take 3 days of treatment every 3 weeks for 2 years in order to be able to be in this process or this system, this treatment that offered the best opportunity. And it was being paid for, since it was an experimental, by NIH. And they paid for probably the first 4 months that I was in that particular regime. And after that, it demonstrated some success, and they stopped the payments. But for all the other families, they didn't have the kind of health insurance that they had. It was $3,000 for every family every 3 weeks. And I listened to these families who's had their children had the same kind of affliction that my child have. And they said, look, we've sold our house. We have the $30,000. We have $20,000. We're able to afford it for 3 months, for 4 months, for 5 months. What kind of chance does my child have to be able to survive? I knew that my child was going to have the best because I had the health insurance of the United States Senate. And I knew that no parent in that hospital had the kind of coverage that I had. That kind of choice for any parent in this country is absolutely unacceptable and wrong, my friends. And I can tell you this. When every member of the United States Senate comes in and signs into the United States Senate, they signed a little card in two places. And one is their signature for their salary, and the other is for their health insurance. Their health insurance. Now, Senator Brown of Ohio, to his credit, will not accept it until the people of Ohio get it. Every other member of the United States Senate, every other member of the United States Senate has accepted it. And for the 15 times that I have fought on the floor of the United States Senate that we ought to have universal comprehensive coverage and to listen to those voices on the other side that have universal and comprehensive coverage and say, no, it is not time. We can't afford it. It's the wrong bill at the wrong time. My friends, if that health insurance is good enough for the members of the Congress of the United States and good enough for the President of the United States, it's good enough for everybody in Montgomery County, everyone in Pennsylvania, and everyone across this country.
Hey guys, this is Mark over at Single Payer Radio. Just a couple notes before Dr. Adams begins this episode. The views and opinions expressed here on Single Payer Radio are those of the speakers and not the station. And you're listening to Single Payer Radio on WFMP LP 106.5. This is Forward Radio. Forward Radio is Louisville's all-volunteer radio station, and we support social, economic, and environmental justice. Help keep Forward Radio going by going to forwardradio.org. Click the donate button, and we'd appreciate it if you could send a few bucks our way. Now, after Garrett's conversation with Bob Cunningham and Antonio Wycliffe, Jill Harmer shares some thoughts on a recent article in Public Citizen. Then we'll end this episode with a rendition of a song by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. And Garrett Adams Jr. delivers that song to us. The name of the song, Wake Up Everybody. And Garrett Sr. has asked that this episode be named Wake Up Everybody.
I am Dr. Garrett Adams, semi-retired physician and emeritus faculty from the University of Louisville School of Medicine. I'm a grateful member of Kentuckians for Single Payer Healthcare since 2006. I'm a past president of Physicians for a National Health Program. I'm grateful to Kentuckians for Single Payer Healthcare and to Forward Radio for this opportunity to meet with you on the radio and with my dear friends, Bob Cunningham and Antonio Wycliffe, to discuss important matters affecting our community and the world. A pandemic caused by a lethal virus and a worldwide pandemic of wealth inequality and racism. Kentuckians for Single Payer Healthcare is a Kentucky organization working to pass universal single payer health insurance as written in the physician's proposal for a national health program. And if you have access to a computer, you can reach Physicians for a National Health Program at pnhp.org and Kentuckians for Single Payer at kyhealthcare.org. Now, full disclosure, since this program is a program about race to some extent, and you can't see us, I should explain that I'm a white man, and my friends whom I will introduce you now are both black Afro-Americans. Bob Cunningham. Right. From Cadiz, Kentucky, where he was born, but he grew up mostly in Louisville. Bob became a leader in the civil rights movement, and locally he was a founder with Susie Post, Maddie Jones, and Angela Davis of the Kentucky Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression. Antonio Wycliffe is a member of the KSPH Steering Committee, and he is on the board of the Kentucky Alliance and treasurer of the Kentucky Alliance. So I'm going to start the questions with Bob. And Bob, you have been a founder of the Alliance Against racist and political repression. Can you explain to us what that is? What is the Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression?
Well, I think many of us have always felt like that unless we do something about race in this country, and all the other things that we attempt is not going to happen. I think the key to us making this a livable and free society has to, first, we have to look at the race. I think Ann Braden used to tell me that a lot, that she always felt like that until we do something about race, that nothing else is possible. And the Kentucky Alliance at one time, I mean, at the founding of the Kentucky Alliance was around the, at that time, of what was going on with Angela Davis. A lot of people know that, I'm sure. And so the Alliance was people who felt like that a person that's speaking for justice, whoever that is, should be able to do that. And we knew that there were forces that didn't ever want that to happen. There are those that profit from racism in this society, and we still know that. And I think there were those of us that felt like that we need to do something about it. You know, there is an old African proverb that says, don't get caught stooping doing standing time. In other words, you got to stand up for something. So we formed the Kentucky Alliance. At that time, there was Alliance chapters in about 5 or 6 other states at that time, including New York, including Vegas, including Chicago, Illinois, that is. So there were people who felt like, again, that we need to, I think all of us felt like that, and I still feel that, that when the followers began to lead, then the leaders would follow. And that's, I think that's what we're seeing today. We're seeing these young people out there who are followers, but they are becoming leaders, and we are listening to them, and we know that this, that there is a movement coming. There's a movement afoot, and I think all of us has something to do about that. I don't think any of us can sit on the sidelines and feel like that this is somebody else's job. No. There is probably a young child standing on a street corner right now in a town, in a city, in this country, who probably has the answer for cancer in his head, in his or her head, but they'll never make it to medical school because they're poor and because they can't afford it. So that's why all of us profits from making this the society that we need that will help people that will help people out of what we are into as of right now.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Antonio, you've been a leader in the Kentucky Alliance. How do you feel about things today as far as race relations in Louisville and in the world?
Well, my assessment is looking at integration, school integration, has helped a great deal. Though there were a lot of opposition to it back in the 70s when it was implemented. But when you speak in regards to creating laws for against discrimination and injustice in our society, laws are only for the law for the ones that's going to abide by the law. The law doesn't do help any for the lawless. And the only way it's going to take the young people coming up now, and we've got to do something about our school system, that Black history needs to be taught as a curriculum in school throughout the year, not just during Black History Month. Because the only way you're going to eradicate prejudice and discrimination is to start with our young folk. And we've got to listen to what our young people are going through today if we're going to make a change. Now, I agree with Bob in the sense, I don't know if he mentioned this earlier, that they need some direction from us, but we have to listen to what they're going through today in order to make a significant change in what's going on around the world, because we still have a lot of older folks that are still caught up in the segregated mindset, and that's exemplified by the parading of the Confederate flag and denouncing wanting to remove any Confederate monuments throughout. So it's going to take our young people to initiate and bring about this change that's needed. But again, it's going to take more than laws. It's going to take education. And we've got to, again, listen to our young folk in terms of what they're going through and mesh how we dealt with it in the past and come up with a solution to how we can deal with it in the present.
Okay. Speaking of young people, I think they're bearing the brunt of the police brutality that is happening throughout this country and could be around the world as far as I know. What's your thought about that, police brutality?
What do I think about it? Well, we know that in regards to police brutality, there's a lot of racists on our police force. I'm sure there's some nationalists on there that's their primary means that's their primary means of exerting their power is by getting on the police force so they can do harm to minorities and people that they feel are not in line with them.
Right. Did you have something to add to that, Bob?
Yes. Specifically for my white brothers and sisters. And I say this because I think too often it's not bad people who do bad things. Sometimes it's good people who do bad things based on bad information. They don't get the right information, and that is something that I think can turn a person around when they begin to hear the truth. Somebody said, "Truth crushed to the ground will rise again." So I think too often, good folk do bad things because of the information that they get, which is bad. So I feel like that is something that, again, Ann used to make sure and let it be known that it takes white folk, along with black folk and all good folk, to do something about race, because it has stood for too long as a weapon that keeps us apart. It keeps me and that white person who may live in Eastern Kentucky away from each other, because we see each other as enemies. Well, we're not enemies. Everything that black folk have walked for, everything we've marched for, was for all of us. When we were talking about school integration, we wasn't talking about good schools for black kids. We were talking about good schools, quality education for everybody. But the voices that they hear tells them that black folks is their enemy. And I think until we get that straight, and I think it's happening today, I think these young people are showing that. I've never seen the diversity in the streets that I've seen in the last couple of months, with black and white kids, with white kids walking around with Black Lives Matter signs. That tells me something. It tells me that we can, and as Antonio said, that education that they need. Not only do they need it in schoolroom, they need it at home. They need it in churches to let us know that we will not make it as long as we fight with each other. Until we begin to understand that we are brothers and sisters to one another and that we need to be putting our strength together and fighting together, we will always lose. And I don't think any of us want that, but that's where we're headed. So I am, as they used to say, tickled to death to see those young people in the streets, as diverse as they are, and taking on the police. And I feel sometimes sorry that the police too often are misguided. I'm saying that to say that they are sent out there by people who wouldn't be a policeman for anything. But they are sent out there to beat heads, and for people like me, they don't understand that they are like me. They don't have the rights that they deserve either. So I think, I just want to commend you for having this conversation, because I think that's what we need more than anything. There's an old brother who's dead now. I met him a few times, John Henry Clark. He was a scholar. He was some of everything. He used to say, what we need more than anything is information, information, information. And I think, again, the fact that you are putting this out there for people to understand, I think it's a great thing. And I'm tickled that you are doing this.
All right, thank you.
I'm kind of shook up right now, and I don't know really what to say, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well,
and yes, like you said, education is the key to freedom.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure, you're right.
And when you look at the cultural changes that have been made, and that's through TV, music, where whites are now meshing their clothing, the music, the other artistry that they're exhibiting is now more like black folks.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I confess to ignorance on my part. When I first came down to the Braden Center in 2006 with Dr. Adewale Troutman, and Kay had arranged for us to give a talk to the members of the Alliance at the Braden Center. And there was that word, racism, Kentucky Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression. I can understand political repression, but when I went down there in 2006, I didn't know what racism was. Can you believe that? I didn't know.
Oh.
I was ignorant. And I'll tell you something else I've been ignorant about. I didn't know what white supremacy was. I didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I had this crazy notion that it meant that white people thought they were smarter because they were white, and that was the supremacy. I didn't realize that it was a power. It was a power over mm-hmm. other people because you're white. I didn't realize that until probably 1982, when I met a brilliant young woman at Johns Hopkins University at the School of Public Health. And this young black woman was so smart. She was smarter than any of us at the whole school. And then I thought to myself, I said, well, there's so much for your funny little idea about white supremacy. Because she screamed on in her knowledge. But now I understand what it means. And so part of that, I'm saying that because of what you all have said about education. I think there has to be a lot of education. Now, another thing that I hope we might get into a little bit is racial justice. And I'm going to ask you what it's like to be black. I want to hear if you are able to say so, if you're able to help us to understand what it means.
Well, Garrett, I want to express a personal experience I went through when I worked for city government.
When you were what?
When I was an employee with city government.
Right, right.
I experienced a lot of discrimination. There were, you know, talks about when I was there and I wanted to, I had aspirations of learning and moving up, and there were those whites that would say, that would badmouth me to other new employees, white employees that would come in. And I didn't try to argue about what they said, whether it was true or not. I felt like, as Dr. King says, you judge somebody by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. So I felt like I would just continue to be me, do what I, be who I am, and in time they would see for themselves the type of person I was.
And, that's right.
And months later, they would come back to me and say, you know, when I first came here, they told me you were this, that, and the other, and I've seen for myself that you're not anything like what they said.
Yeah, of course not. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. That's good. That's good. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Were you going to say something, Bob?
Yeah. With me, I think I have always, even from a child, and I'm 85 years old now, I have always seen it as a different chemistry within black folk about, say, this nation than white folk. Why is that? One of the reasons is that black folks came to this nation in chains. White folks came here to escape chains. So chains now, I'm talking about chains around your feet and chains around your hand. So my point is, I think when I hear the national anthem, it don't make me cry. Sometimes it makes me mad. Why? Because I know they couldn't be talking about me. Mm. It couldn't be, you know? So I think that every day I walk out of my house, I'm reminded. Now let me say, back up and say, I have many white friends. I have marched with white folk in Mississippi that were brothers and sisters of mine. So I'm not talking about individual white people. I'm talking about those who forever tell me they're not racist. And I'm not concerned that much about that. I wonder how anti-racist are you? What do you do against racism? You don't have to continue to tell me how you're not racist. I know that when I see you fighting against racism. So I think that too often white folk are not afraid of black folks as they may appear to be. They're afraid of other white folk. So if you don't want to other your neighbors to see you and see my family or my wife and I coming to your house for dinner, then you're not afraid of me. You're afraid of what they may think. So I'm saying that to say I think oftentimes white folk act racist because of other white folk. What other white folk may think about me if I don't laugh at that black joke that they just told. So I better laugh too. So my point is, I think oftentimes, and I said it earlier, I think good white folk do bad things because they're trying to show other white folk as to that. I believe that too. And I think that that's wrong. And I say that because I feel like that there were good white folk that would have, and they did, some of them did, would have fought against slavery until their death because they knew it was wrong. But many times they didn't say anything. That silence is betrayal, I think. When you don't say anything about something that you know is wrong, those who have the privilege to know has the duty to act. That's why you act. Because you have the privilege to know right from wrong. You know what's right, and you act on it. But many of them who know it and know something is wrong don't say anything for the sake of the neighbor next door or the people that they know or the friends of theirs. So I guess what I'm saying is we all have the responsibility to do something about what this nation is about. Because if you don't think of yourself, think of your grandchild, think of your niece and nephews, think of the kids that you have coming behind you. I'm going to tell you a little story. I hope this is something that you can take off the tape if you don't think it. I used to work with Louisville Water Company. I was a meter reader. I worked with a white brother he and I were just like real brothers. We walked through neighborhoods and read water meters. One day we was out in the South End. This has been a long time ago. We were walking from yard to yard reading water meters. A little boy, white boy, who seemed to have been no older than 6 years old, was walking with us for about three or four doors from where he lived. His mother was in the doorway yelling for him to come here. You come home. Well, he continued to walk with us. Then all at once he asked me, said, "Are you a nigger?" Oh. I said, "No, Jody." Jody was his name because his mother kept calling him, "Jody, you come in this house. You come here right now." I said, "No, I don't think so." He continued to walk with us. Yeah. Then he asked me, "Do you kill people?" Oh. I said, "Kill people? No, Jody, I don't." He said, "My mother told me that." Yeah. Now, I often think of Jody today, of what could have happened to him. No. What could happen? I wish I knew where Jody was and what happened to him. So I guess I'm saying that to say that we sometimes get it from our children. We may not realize it, but we get it from our children. And we poison them. So try to make a better world, if not for me and my children, try to make a better world for your own children, because you're poisoning them too. And sometimes I don't think we know that.
Yeah, and Bob, I'm inclined to agree with what you said earlier about it's not the white folks that are not racist, are discriminated against other black folks. It's those that aren't willing to speak up when they're around their other folks and they hear people make racist comments. And I experienced that. They would come back. The ones that weren't racist would come back and tell me the things that were said about me, but they would yeah. not speak up against
me. I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, you know, their fellow individuals when they were around them.
Okay, all right.
Comments.
I'm a thrift store junkie. I'm in and out of thrift stores, and I meet a lot of people that way. And it's a lady that I met. She lives out in the Shively area, and a white lady, older lady, old as I am. And when Obama was running for president, one day we were in the store together. I was in there. She was too. She walked up to me and she whispered, "I voted for Obama." Now, she was whispering because she didn't want other people to hear it. I said, "Well, I'm glad you did, but why are you whispering?" You see? Now, here's a lady who is a beautiful person. You know, but she had to whisper because she didn't want other white folk to hear her say that she voted for Obama. So I'm saying that to say, sometimes I think you're not afraid of me. You may be afraid of your neighbor, or maybe your minister, or maybe the person who sat beside you in church on Sunday. But I think things are looking good, and I feel a lot better. Even at my age, I feel as though that things will happen. I may not be around. But these young people who are out there today, who are not afraid of the police, and they are good policemen, let me understand, make you understand that. But what I'm saying is they're putting their life on the line for what is right. And that means a lot. That means a whole lot. Okay.
But in regards to the police, until they're willing to weed out the bad ones that they know are in their group, to be silent is just as bad as if you were out there doing something.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way it was up there in Minneapolis. Those other guys should have jumped in. They shouldn't have allowed that to happen.
Exactly.
That's unbelievable.
You know, that's that fear I was talking about that they have of each other.
Yeah. Well, one thing I would like to ask you fellas to comment on is if you see a place for publicly funded national health insurance as we come to grips with systemic and structural racism, Is there a role for improved publicly funded Medicare for all, single payer?
Oh, sure. I mean, that with the pandemic that's going on, made it evident that there's a need for Medicare, improved Medicare for all. With the black people disproportionately being affected by it, and I'm sure there's probably a lot of poor white folks as well.
Sure.
Adversely affected. It's right there, staring them straight in the face. They just don't want to admit it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are people, and people I know, and not only that, people in my own family, who has to cut their pills in half because they can't afford medical care. They can't afford what the pill would cost. I'm saying that to say that it's a shame that people have to die because they can't afford medical care. And we have many that are doing that every day. So I guess one of the biggest crimes against this country is to not afford, not make health care affordable for those who die every day because they didn't have what they needed in order to pay for health care. And the pharmaceutical companies, they are, to me, drug dealers. Maybe right. they are drug dealers. And what I'm saying is, you go to get an if you now have a headache and you can't afford an aspirin, you have to continue to have your headache. That's sad. So no, I think health care should be free. If anything should be free, it should be health care. Because people, everybody's going to get sick. I know because I'm 85 years old, and I can't afford to get sick. I can't afford to pay for what the doctor or the pharmaceutical company is going to charge me. So I have to sometimes bear my pain. So no, I think that we ought to. And as a matter of fact, I think most people should know that. I think they make us think it's not possible. You know, it can happen. Sure it can. I mean, we can afford as a nation to make health care affordable to everybody, or make health care free, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, well, Bob, what I think happens is those that have what they consider good health care don't look beyond their door to see that there's other folks out there.
Right.
Don't have the benefit of good health care that you may have and are suffering. So they don't care. They only think about self. And I have good, what I consider good health care, but I don't look at it as far as how.
I know.
I look at how is it affecting other folks out here who don't have what I have.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Adams, I've been to Cuba 3 times. And one of the things, I guess, that struck me even the first time I was there, that they have free health care from the cradle to the grave. If you talk to a young person, and I've been to the University of Havana. I talk to young people, many of them doctors. Many of them are going to be doctors. I ask them why. Now, the average kid, I would think, who go to school in this country to be a doctor, if you ask him, he tell you the truth, or her, she tell you the truth, they want to be a doctor because that's where the money is. The kids in Cuba will tell you because there are diseases. There are many sick people in my country. I want to be able to do, that's why they want to be a doctor. Now that, I mean, you know, people here don't hear that. So my point is, it showed me right then what free health care will do for a person. But free health, how many healthy people we would have, children and others, old people like me, if health care was affordable.
Yeah.
So no, I think that everybody who really thinks about what health care costs in this country, the cost that's out of sight for people who can't afford it, there's many people right now who are sick because they can't afford to buy the medication that they need, or can't afford to hire the doctor that they need. And, so, no, that's one thing that one of the reasons that
when I, that's one of the things I ask a politician that's running for office, that before I vote for them, that's one of the things I want to know. Will you make health care more affordable for people? Because we all are going to get sick at some point and die if we can't afford to what it takes to make us well.
One of the problems we have is we've got career politicians in office who taking money from lobbyists of these pharmaceutical companies.
Okay, you're right.
And they don't care that people out here suffering. They only look at their bottom line is how much richer can I get? And instead, politicians go into office probably making a few $100,000 and end up millionaires.
Amen.
As a nonprofit organization, Physicians for National Health Program, we don't recommend any one person for any political office. But if you look around, you'll find somebody for sure that could really help us a whole lot in the U.S. Senate. I don't want to name any names, but I think this man is really for real, and I think if everybody gets behind him, I think we might see some changes for the better. Maybe you can figure out who I'm talking about. I'll just say a couple of things, if I will, about information. And I wonder if I think African American people know that their risk of serious illness and death from bad illness, such as this COVID disease, relative risk for death for a black person is about 3.5 times the white in this time, at this time. It's just disproportionately affecting the people of color. And one reason is because they already have illnesses. And those people who have these illnesses, like high blood pressure or lung disease or heart disease or diabetes, they're much more susceptible to the virus. And so higher death rates and illness from the thing. The other thing is the incarceration and the crowded housing, decreased access to health care and resources, and just plain poverty, so that black patients are dying at much higher rates than their population share. I guess people may sort of know that, but here's something that I think is going to be very useful if it works out. And we mentioned having health insurance, and Antonio says he's got good insurance, and that's good. That usually fortunate, and I know you know that. But there are 40 million unemployed Americans that have lost their health insurance because they lost their job. So all those people. And Bernie Sanders and Ms. Jayapal, Congressman from Washington State, have a bill that's called the Healthcare Emergency Guarantee Act. It takes effect immediately and would remain in place until Secretary of Human Services certifies to Congress that an FDA-approved coronavirus vaccine is widely available to the U.S. public. So if we put it into effect right now to provide health for all during the pandemic, fully cover the cost of medically necessary health care, including prescription drugs. Now, that's a bill that's in the Congress. So some of this is political will. And how we get from here to there, I'm not sure, but I know that the African American community in this country is really suffering. That the infant mortality rate is about three times in what it is. And maternal mortality is way high. It's way more than three times the white maternal mortality.
Yeah.
Black pregnancy-related mortality is 40 times, whereas white would be 12. So it's just way up there. So, but anyhow, now I'm kind of playing my own song here about single payer. But if there's a way to get, I look at these crowds and I think, what if they were in the street to protest for single payer care so they could get Medicare for all? And then what are different if all of the people had the care? And you know that Dr. King said, of all the forms of discrimination and inequalities, health is the most shocking and inhuman.
That's true.
Well, I believe that a national, publicly financed, single-payer health plan would be the best thing that could ever happen to this country.
Oh, God, yeah.
At one time, at least for on one level, health, everyone becomes the same.
Okay.
Not only improve the nation's health status, but we seriously commit ourselves to true democracy with liberty and justice for all. And we build a better society that more equality can bring. So that's the end of my little speech on health care.
Yeah. That's important. That's important.
Really appreciate so much you all. I think that for my part, I've got some friends, cousins, and so on that where we've gotten together and talked about some of the issues about race. And it's been a mixture of white and black people. And what I came away from that several summers ago, we used to do it in the summers, was when I got to know those people, it made a big difference. And I think if we can get to know each other and appreciate what each other is about, then I think some of the problems will drift away. So just final words from Antonio. Got any final words for us?
Well, I just feel like we're on the right path. We just have to stand firm and don't give up the fight. Don't allow others to distract us from what needs to be done. And I think if we do it right at the ballot box, we should be on the road to overcome.
All right. Bob?
Yeah, I think that we have to look at where we are. What are we doing? You know, too often we want other people to do something and then we don't think about, wait a minute, what have I done? I think all of us have something that we can do that would bring this, make this a better society. You may have to do it in your own house. You may have to do it in your own church. You may have to do it on the assembly line where you work if you're lucky enough to have a job. But I think all of us has a role to play. And as I said earlier, if you don't think about yourself, think about those young kids that's coming along behind you. You know, and they're going to ask you sometime, what did you do during that time? And don't lie to them. If you didn't do anything, tell them that. But when you've stood up like you do, Antonio, if you stood up like you do, Dr. Adams, then you can tell them the truth. I was out there. I was doing something. So what I mean is I think it's on all of us. And we can't pass the torch to these kids if we don't stand up for them, and I think we have to do that. And I think that things are looking brighter to me now, let's say, than they did a little while ago. I think things are going to, I'm not going to be fooled by, you know, I know that there are people that's going to want to turn those kids around. You can believe that, you know. There are people that are, not only will they put water hoses on them, they'll shoot them if they can. So my point is, let's all know that we'll win together, or we'll lose separated as we are.
All right. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much, Antonio.